Welcome to the Real Estate Espresso Podcast, your morning shot of what's new in the world of real estate investing. I'm your host, Victor Menashe. This is the weekend edition. We have a very special show for you today. Today's show is a recording from a live talk at the Underwriting Masterclass held in Ottawa, Canada, back in November. Enjoy today's conversation about how to invest in a high interest rate environment.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a great day. Mayor was here, Jenna Suds was here, all of the great work for the Kanata Food Cupboard. When Matt told me about this crazy idea, I thought, man, that's ambitious, and he surpassed it, so congratulations. So I'm Victor Menashe, president of OREO, host of the Real Estate Espresso podcast. Put up your hand if you listen to the show. We've got a few listeners, awesome. This is a daily show 7 days a week. That's right, 7 days a week. Episode 2100 and something, I think, dropped this week. So I've been doing this a little while. Why would I be so crazy as to do a daily show? That's a real hamster wheel some days. The reason is because amateurs don't do daily. Amateurs don't do daily. And so when you look at the landscape of podcasts out there, there's a lot of content, but a lot of it's actually amateurs. This show is really targeting sophisticated real estate investors, folks that are really doing this at a high level on a day-to-day basis, and I think you'll get value from it. I'd love to have you as a listener. But that's not what I do really day-to-day. What I do is I build things, primarily in the United States. We do a little bit here in Canada, but we're primarily U.S.-based. We're developers of apartments, senior housing, storage, some light industrial. We do a lot of land, close to 2,000 acres of land under development right now. And we do this pretty much across the United States. We're in, we have more than a dozen projects right now. It's been a natural progression. I did not start doing large-scale land development. I started with a single condo here in Ottawa, just like everybody else. Started with just one property with a thesis that the property would have some reason for being rented. And that thesis turned out to be true. And it was a good business. It wasn't a great business. And then 2008 happened in the United States, and I saw what I thought was the opportunity of a lifetime, which it was. But I was just starting at that point in time, and I was learning and making tons of mistakes and didn't truly capitalize on it anywhere near to the extent that I could have. I wasted a lot of time. And even with that, have managed to, bit by bit, through the compound effect, by attracting better and better team members and better opportunities to do more and more. So I don't want you to think just because you're going to look at this and say, okay, you know, Victor's doing these, you know, 1,000-acre deals, that it seems out of reach. It's an incremental process, and it is a very natural progression. This is a small project we're doing in Caldwell, Idaho, just a suburb of Boise. It's 28 acres. We're in the process of negotiating. It's fully site plan approved. We're in the process of negotiating the sale of it right now to an institutional player that has about 35,000 units in their portfolio right now. And this will be 74 single-family homes, 64 towns, and 120 apartments. And that was one of the projects we did over the past year. We've also done larger things. This is 1,783 acres. This is the zoning map. It's on the edge of Colorado Springs. When Matt asked me to speak, he said, I'd like you to talk about investing in a high interest rate environment. Would that be cool, learn how to invest in a high interest rate environment? Well, one way to do that and do that effectively is not to borrow at all. In that case, the interest rate doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. And I don't say that just to be funny. You want to keep that in the back of your mind, because some projects that actually makes sense. And this is one of those ones where it made sense, where this project was 100% equity funded, because it's a long range project. To build this out eventually is going to take about 15 years. And of course, we're going to go through a number of economic cycles during that time period. It'd be crazy to assume otherwise. So we bought this land at 23 cents a square foot, which I think is a decent number. It's on the edge of the city. We started the annexation petition on this project in August of 2022, and I expect we'll be fully annexed and entitled in Q1. We were hoping for Q4 this year. We just had our Parks and Recreation hearing this week. We have two more hearings, one with City Council, one with utilities, before we can be fully annexed. Post-annexation, the value of this land should go between $4 to $5 a square foot. So from these are American dollars, real money. Yeah. Exactly. You can do the math on 77 million square feet. It's a pretty decent lift. Now, this is going to be about 8,400 rooftops when it's all done, four different densities of residential, retail, commercial, industrial, schools, fire department, electric substations, office park, childcare, you name it, arterial roads, the whole thing, the whole nine yards we're building, with some amazing partners. And it's a matter of just putting together those right relationships to get deals like this done. We got this done last year. It's not done, but we're on the path. This is one of several projects, as I mentioned. We are always mindful of our investors. That's why we do this. It's to really build communities that are going to be compelling for people to live in, but we're mindful of our investors. And in today's environment, people are scared. They're scared because, I mean, you can't even trust your bank. Where's your money safe? And it's really first and foremost about safety, and then second about yield. But it's first and foremost about safety. There's a lot going on in the market. I'm going to share a lot of U.S. statistics because that is our perspective. We're a little bit more U.S.-based than Canadian. But we have to be very mindful. In the United States last year, there were over 935,000 completions of multifamily. That's a 40-year record, more completions in multifamily than any other year in recent memory. And there's a number of communities, hot communities, Austin, Texas, Salt Lake City, that have attracted so much new supply that, frankly, they're oversupplied. And this myth that we keep hearing about a housing shortage in the United States, the National Association of Realtors says they're short 7 million homes. I think it's nonsense, absolute nonsense. Maybe short 2 million homes, maybe. But if you think back to 2008, there were four counties that led the nation in terms of distress: Miami-Dade County, Broward County, Maricopa County, which is Phoenix, Arizona, and Vegas. Those were the four counties that led the nation in distress in terms of the number of foreclosures. What do those four counties have as characteristics? A very high proportion of second homes. Very high proportion of second homes. How many Airbnbs are there out there today? In a moment of distress, people will get rid of their second property and protect the homestead. We could see a lot of that shadow inventory reappear in the marketplace, not just in the U.S., but in Canada too. Now, I know people will say, okay, there's only 1,200 Airbnbs in Ottawa, it's less than 1% of the market, blah, blah, blah. Still, there is supply, there is shadow inventory that could reappear in the market. So we have to be mindful of that. I'm a big believer in the laws of supply and demand, which means I treat it like a law of gravity. You know, it's like the law of physics. If you violate the laws of supply and demand, you run the risk of getting hurt. We do a little bit here in Ottawa. This is a project that we are looking to pull out of the ground starting in Q1 on Richmond Road. It's a AAA location. So we do things here in Canada as well. We have the perspective of both. I want to talk a little bit about inflation. And I think inflation is one of these things that's poorly understood. And it's super important. Inflation is, frankly, your ticket to wealth in real estate. Now, that may sound strange. Put up your hand if you think that inflation is the increase in prices. Awesome. I'm so glad that no hands went up, because inflation is not the increase in prices. Inflation is the inflation of the money supply, which causes a devaluation of that currency. That is inflation. And the increase in prices is a symptom of that increase in the money supply. It's like, imagine if, for a moment, if diamonds weren't scarce anymore, would they be worth as much? No. If gold wasn't as scarce anymore, would it be worth as much? If that baseball card, that one pristine, mint-condition Jackie Robinson baseball card, if there were 100,000 of it, would it be worth as much? No. It's about supply and demand. And it's the same law of supply and demand pertains to dollars, pertains to real estate, pertains to gold, pertains to everything. So it's the flooding of the money supply. The money supply in the United States has grown almost 20% a year. I mean, think about it. The U.S. deficit, the government deficit, they're running 8.5% of GDP. That's massive. The only way that they can repay that debt is by devaluing it. So three things happen in an inflationary environment. Number one, the purchasing power for people on fixed income gets wiped out. Number two, your savings get wiped out. And number three, your debt gets wiped out. So if you know that, how would you organize your affairs to come out on the winning side of that equation? Get as much debt as you can handle safely. Absolutely. If you can get a 50-year CMHC loan at a fixed interest rate, now, yeah, you got to renew every 10 years, but in the States, it's even better. You can get a 40-year fully amortized loan that's rate locked at the beginning of the loan. Oh, my goodness. That's a license to print money. That's what you want. You want to take advantage of that inflationary environment. We've got this situation where we have exponential growth in debt. And debt is a claim on future earnings. But if the earnings aren't growing faster than the debt, you know what the ending's going to be? It's going to end in default. The math tells you that. It's going to end in default. And the only way out of it is for the government to inflate their way out. I thought they were going to do it in 2022 and 21 and 22 when inflation started to ramp up. I was thinking, man, they're going to inflate away the debt now. And then Jerome Powell stood up and said, oh, we got to fight inflation. He squandered that opportunity. Now, yes, inflation is painful for the population. There's no question. Nobody likes to pay more for your groceries and so on. But whenever you have price inflation, you also have asset price inflation. You also have devaluation of the debt. It's a theft, frankly. It is a transfer of wealth from one group of folks to another. We'll have to call it what it is. But if you know that that's the game, organize your affairs to come out on the winning side of that equation. I'll give you a very simple example. This is a building that our team built in Philadelphia. We built this in 2013, and we built it for $88 a square foot. Now, this is an example. I'm just going to use round numbers, and I'll show you the real numbers. So we built this building. It's a 10-unit building for about $1 million. And imagine for a moment that you financed it 80% and you put down $200,000, 20% in cash. And imagine for a moment that inflation was running 10%. So rents go up 10%. I'm doing simple math here, so the mathematicians, please don't bring out your knives because I know there's errors in the math here. A year later, this property potentially could be worth 10% more. Now, in a year, you're not going to have paid down much, if any, of the principal on the loan. So let's say you still have an $800,000 loan at the end of 1 year, approximately. But your equity has gone from $200,000 to $300,000. Now, what other investment could you make with a 50% return? All you have to do is sleep. Like, none. Now, the mathematicians will say, okay, but those dollars are worth 10% less, so $300,000 is really worth $270,000 in last year's dollars. Okay, so it's only 35% return, not 50. But still, that's pretty okay. And when you compound that over multiple years, this is where that theft that gets hidden when it's only 1% and 2% really starts. You get to see the multiplier, that compounding effect of that devaluation of the currency. So these are the real numbers. We built this property. We bought the land for $135,000. We built it all in for $1,050,000. The rents went up. From the day that we started this particular project, we figured the rents in the best units were going to be $1,200 a month. And by the time we were finished, they were $1,450 a month. And that just happened over the span of literally a year and a bit. And we went from property that we thought was just going to be okay. We built it at $88 a square foot, which we thought was expensive at the time. We were hoping to build in the 70s. We said, oh, 88 bucks a square foot. I wonder if we can do it. I mean, we would dream to build today at 88 bucks a square foot, right? But at the time, it felt expensive. And the reason I'm telling you that is because even at today's, whatever your number is, 250 a square foot, 220 a square foot, maybe 300 a square foot, you're going to say, shoot, that's expensive. We're going to wish to build at 2023 prices in a couple of years from now. I promise you, we're going to wish we could build at those prices. We got it leased up. It took us 5 months to lease it up. It reappraised at $1.8 million. The bank gave us back $1.3 million, which was more than we put into it. So we put a couple of bucks in our jeans. And then we ultimately sold this last year for $2.2 million, something like that. It's partly value creation. We created a nice property in a so-so neighborhood, but we bought up the entire neighborhood because we did multiple projects all in that immediate area. But the biggest effect was actually inflation. And you don't want to think that you're smarter than you really are. It's easy to let this go to your head and say, boy, look what I did. Well, no, you didn't. That was a rising tide that lifts all boats. The other thing that happens is, of course, over time, everything goes up. Rents go up, expenses go up, but your profit margin goes up. So your debt coverage improves over time as well. The longer you hold onto your properties, the more profit it generates. So we don't like to sell. Now, sometimes we will because someone offers us a stupid number, but the more you hold on to a property that's generating positive cash flow, especially if you've refinanced out of it and is now delivering infinite return, what are you going to go buy to replace it that's going to be better than that? Maybe you could buy two, maybe. But if you're getting that infinite return, which is not a taxable event, remember, a refinance is not a taxable event, whereas a sale is a taxable event. Sometimes you're better off just holding it. Okay, I'm going to take you through a fictitious example here, but it's to illustrate a point and show you what I think the opportunity is right now, like right now, especially over the next 12 to 18 months. Any project that was built or purchased and improved over the last 2 to 3 years would have had a fundamental assumption that the interest rates would have been fairly low. That first digit would have started with a 3. 3 point something would have been the number. And today it's much higher than that. So I'm going to take you through an example. This was a 120-unit apartment building that we modeled in Texas, where originally it was going to be financed at 80% loan to cost as a new build. The initial interest rate of the construction loan really doesn't matter because it's only a short-term bridge loan. And what really matters is the interest rate for the permanent loan, for your permanent financing. You just build the big enough interest reserve as part of your construction budget and life has a way of working out. Again, as long as you don't have an extended construction period, things don't take too long, you're not going to run out of cash, you should be okay. So whoever built this building was going to be assuming that when they converted into permanent financing, they would have been getting a number that started with a 3, 3 1/4, something like that. And they would be looking to hit their debt coverage minimum of 1.25. And the property at 80% loan to value would have given them just under $40 million in loan proceeds. And they would have got back $5.6 million that they could return to investors. So out of the original $8.5 million in equity that was contributed, 5.6 of that gets returned to the investors on refinance of the project. It's not a full cash out refi, but it's still pretty decent. The investors get to take a lot of their chips off the table. And there's hundreds and hundreds of deals all over the United States and Canada built with these assumptions. Fast forward to today, let's look at what happens when interest rates go up. The first thing is that the loan amount's going to go down, mostly because your debt coverage is going to go down. And you're not going to be limited by loan to value. You're going to be limited by debt coverage because when you read a term sheet for your loan, it's going to say the lesser of 80% loan to value or 75% loan to value, whatever that particular term is, or a debt coverage of 1.25, or again, or whatever the lender is requiring for that debt coverage ratio. In today's environment, loan to value is irrelevant. It's all debt coverage. Every single loan is debt coverage limited. I'm sure you see this as well all day long. So let's imagine that the interest rate goes up to 6%. It's higher today, but let's say it's 6%. Now your debt coverage is 0.89. The lender's not going to allow you to have negative cash flow. So they're going to have to reduce the loan proceeds in order to get this back into conformity with a debt coverage of 1.25. Now what's going to happen is in order to hit that, the loan amount's been reduced from $39 million and change to $27.9 million. And not only are you not getting back $5.6 million in cash to put in your jeans, you've got to find another $6.3 million to bring to the table in additional equity just to get into your permanent financing, to get out of your bridge loan. If you're that sponsor, that property owner, that developer that did that deal, you're sweating bullets. You're saying, how am I going to come up with $6.3 million? What do you do? Do you go back to your initial investors and do a capital call? Call Chad Robinson? Right? Do you sell new equity to new investors? What's the story? Well, we miscalculated the interest rate. The returns are going to stink. But we need the money. Please help us. Like, what? Like, what is the story here that you're going to sell to investors? There's no path. There is no path for this borrower to get into permanent financing unless they can find a way to come up with the equity through some other means, maybe cross-collateralize it with another property, something. But they have a huge, huge problem. And virtually any bridge loan that was written from 2020 to today, well, let's say from 2020 to 2022, over that three-year period, they're in this situation, absolutely. So problem is, of course, they're over-leveraged. You've got no path to repaying the loan. They don't have sufficient covering equity. They're upside down. There's no story. This is the very definition of distress. Now, some of this has not appeared in the marketplace yet because they're still haven't run out of extensions on their bridge loan. They're still paying the high rate of interest, hoping that maybe interest rates come down in 6 months or a year. But eventually, they're going to run out of extensions, and the lender is going to say, well, enough's enough. These are what are starting to appear in the marketplace, even in multifamily, and I'm going to show you other examples as well. So these folks are looking for the fastest path to liquidity. They are looking for any kind of solution. Many of these properties are going to result in power sale or, depending on the jurisdiction, in foreclosures. Now, by the time it gets to a foreclosure and it goes to an auction on the courthouse steps, that's when all of the vultures come out. So how do you compete? We actually observed an auction today. In an auction environment, do you get the lowest price? No. No. The price gets bid up. Thank you, Billy. Right? The price gets bid up. So you don't want to go in an auction environment if you're a buyer. You want to buy a property before it gets to the auction. Absolutely before it gets to the auction. So the opportunity are to find these distressed deals. Now, in a lot of cases, by the time it goes to foreclosure, the equity is wiped out. The equity is gone, and whoever's buying it is buying it for the loan value. Now, if you're one of those poor equity investors that was part of that, or if you're the original deal sponsor, and not only are you going to lose this property to foreclosure, you're also probably going to basically be out of business because no one's going to lend to you on the next deal or the one after that, not for a long, long, long time, you're out of business. So there's a very strong incentive for both the original equity holders and the original deal sponsor to get a deal done before it goes over the crest of the cliff and ends up on the courthouse steps. Okay? Is this making sense? Okay. So the question is, who's going to take the haircut? That's really what this is. It's all about the negotiation. Who's taking the haircut? Now, the alternative is, as we already said, the equity gets wiped out. That's a tough, tough message. The equity gets wiped out. That's kind of a given. So anything that's better than getting wiped out is a plus. You're not looking to give the original investors their forecast 20% IRR or anything like that. You're just looking to help them preserve their capital, and they will be happy with that. They'll get to fight another day. At least they're not gone. And you can do well and do good at the same time. So how do you insert yourself into this mess to create those situations or to create the solution to these problems? First thing is, you probably heard that there's a big gulf in expectations between buyer and sellers today, and that's absolutely true. We call that price discovery, where the seller is looking backwards at what prices were 2 years ago, and the buyer is looking forward saying, I expect 6 months from now I'm going to buy this for 30 cents on the dollar, and there's this massive gulf in between. We're now starting to see that price discovery turn into real, actual transactions, and I'll show you what I mean by that. I believe that inflation is here to stay. And the reason inflation is here to stay is because politicians want to get reelected, which means that they're going to overspend. It's just a fact. We live in a democracy, and because they want to get reelected, they're going to overspend. That's what they do. That's just what they do. Now, not so much at the state or the city and provincial level because they can't print money, But at the federal level, warm up the printing presses, folks, because that's what they do. You're going to require a discount, a substantial discount. And I don't mean 10%. We're looking at bigger discounts than that. But you can rescue the situation. And I'm going to give you a couple examples and before giving you the punchline on how to actually get this done. This is a portfolio in Dallas and Houston, Apple's way. This was Jay Gadjavelli, one of Brad Sumrock's students. He mismanaged this. He focused primarily on accumulating assets. He lost about 3,200 units to foreclosure. The lender was Arbor Realty Trust. But there were, and there's more distress coming behind this with this particular individual. There's already over 120 lawsuits that have been filed. I'm sure when the investigation's all done, they'll find securities violations and all the rest. But this is kind of classic mismanagement. I'm not talking about these situations, although these situations will surface. We will see more of these. I'm talking even about properties that were well managed, that were done ethically, that were done properly, still even those running into trouble. When these things come on the market, the vultures come out. Some of these are big brand names, like Blackstone. They raised a $30 billion opportunity fund. Translation, vulture fund. Okay, Fundamental Partners out of New York City, they actually acquired that portfolio of 3,200 units for $30 million less than the loan value. And that happened one day after the foreclosure. So it was already teed up, ready to go. The money was already there. You didn't have a chance. If you wanted to bid on that, you had no chance. So how do you get in front of this before the vultures get to the table? Because if you're going up against Blackstone, you're going to lose. You're going to lose. You're not going to get to see that property. You're not even going to get to see it. It's already pre-sold before it comes off the, you know, before the gavel hits at the courthouse steps. So how do you do that? How do you get in these conversations and see these deals before they happen? That's what we're going to talk about. And this is where I think the small investor, frankly, has an advantage. Because you're there to help. You're not a vulture. You're there to help. So office buildings in New York are now trading at 30 cents on the dollar. And that's been precipitated further by the failure of WeWork, who broke the lease on 40 properties. Just before the bankruptcy, they had 47 properties. Now they're consolidating down to 7. So 40 buildings are without a tenant right now, literally overnight. 3 of those buildings warned their investors that they're probably going bankrupt. This is what's happening. It's been predicted. It's been widely predicted, but we're seeing it now. So this is the time to be ready to hop into the market and seize those opportunities and do good for maybe some of the original investors, but do well for your own investors as well. Okay, so where do you find them? Talk to commercial mortgage brokers. These are the folks that wrote the original bridge loan. They know what's going on with their borrowers. They know that their borrowers are in trouble. Talk to commercial real estate brokers. They are also getting hints of what's going on here. You want to talk to other limited partners, other investors that are invested in some of these projects. They don't have the power necessarily to influence, but they are very incented to get these projects to safety. So they will be out there reaching out, whispering to folks saying, can you help? You want to talk to them as well. Blackstone's not necessarily having those conversations. They will be having some for sure, but you have the opportunity to have those conversations by leveraging relationship. Let's talk a little bit about structure. If you think about the capital stack, you've got your senior debt here at the top. Then you have mezzanine debt, your secondary financing. Then you have this thing called preferred equity, which I'm going to define in a moment. And then you have your traditional equity. Where people are getting into trouble is either with their senior debt or their mezzanine debt with the secondary financing. That's typically where they're running into trouble. They're undercapitalized. They need to bring additional equity to the table. So if we go back to our example before, remember we had to bring $6.3 million. Our loan-to-value ratio, $27.9 million for that senior loan, is 56% loan-to-value. They were hoping for 80. Now 56% loan-to-value, that's a very low ratio, or might be considered a low ratio. What if you could be a white knight and prevent that equity from getting wiped out. You could bring mezzanine debt, but that's probably not the best solution because the lender is already concerned and they're not going to agree to having other debt postponed behind them. It's going to need to be equity. They're going to insist that the borrower brings additional equity. Whether it's common equity or preferred equity, they don't care. As long as it starts with the letter E, as long as it's equity, that's all they care. So, what is preferred equity? Preferred equity basically postpones the payment to the common shareholders behind the preferred equity. You get to eat first at the table. When we talk about the waterfall, the order precedence, who gets paid first? First, the expenses get paid, the taxes get paid, the senior lender gets paid. Then the preferred equity gets paid, and then the equity. They eat last. So, of course, the last money in, the money that saved the project, should have preferential terms. They shouldn't be coming in. It wouldn't be fair to come in on the same terms as the common equity. Wouldn't make sense. You've added more value, created more leverage. You've done more to save the project than anybody else. So, of course, it makes sense for you to have better terms than anybody else. Now, you can go to the original common equity holders and offer them the same terms. You say, if you want to add to your investment, it's called pay to play. You can also participate in the preferred equity round. No reason not to accept their funds as part of that package. Does that make sense? Okay. So let's look at the original balance sheet that we had. So when we started out, we had $34 million in bridge financing. We had $8.6 million in equity. Under the new balance sheet, you've got $27.9 million in senior debt. You still have the original $8.5 million in equity. And we've inserted the shortfall, the $6.3 million in the middle, in the form of preferred equity. That's how we're solving the shortfall, is by putting it in the middle as preferred equity. When you look at the income statement, you've got some revenue that's coming in, you deduct the expenses, you pay the debt service, and then there's some cash flow left over. That cash flow that's left over right now, for the time being, is going to the preferred equity, and the common equity gets zero. Put up your hand if you think that's unfair. It's perfectly fair. It's perfectly fair. The equity gets to live and fight to see another day. They're not wiped out. It's better than the alternative. That's the truth. And the beauty is, through the magic of inflation, as long as you don't get upside down and get into a situation where this property is going to the courthouse steps, they're actually going to be okay eventually. I can't tell you when. I can't tell you if it's going to be in 5 years or 10, but they will be okay. They'll be okay because rents will go up. Inflation will work its magic. The debt's going to get devalued. The profitability of the project's going to grow. We've seen it for the last 100 years. It's just the way it works. Unless your thesis is that rental property is going to disappear and people are not going to need to rent properties anymore and demand's just going to evaporate, that's just how it works. Inflation will perform its magic. Just don't get upside down and it's going to be okay. So in year one, there'll be $500,000 of cash flow. The return to the preferred investors is 7.9% cash on cash. It's okay. It's not fabulous. It's okay. But you got what is arguably a $50 million property for $6 million, and you get to be first in line. That's okay. That's decent. You got a lot of upside. You know that the debt coverage today is 1.25. You know it's going to grow over time because inflation is going to do its thing. The same thing is true for the cash on cash return. It's 7.9% today, but by year 10, it's going to be in the mid to upper teens. Again, it's going to be decent. At that point, you're probably paying out to the common equity holders as well, because you're throwing off enough cash that the preferred equity will have been repaid, and now you can start to share some of the earnings with the common equity. Obviously, you got to do your due diligence. You can't pay too much. You got to make sure that there aren't any skeletons in the closet or any landmines that are going to make this blow up even further. But there are opportunities to come in, to be a white knight, and to rescue these projects. That's what I would do in today's environment. That's what we are doing in today's environment. Of course, projects that we started 2-3 years ago, you got to finish those. You know, there is no reverse gear in land development or in real estate development. You can only go forward. You can pause, but you can't go backwards. So you obviously have to take those forward. This is a difficult time to be playing defense in real estate. It's an amazing time to be playing offense. This feels very 2008-ish to me. And so the more you can be positioned to get into these negotiations and to help folks that are in distress to solve a real problem, you can do well and do good at the same time. And with that, I'll open it to questions.